I'm Michael G. Haskins.
I'm Bob Henley.
We've launched Haskins and Henley Drive Time for the 99%.
Let's be generous, Drive Time for the 99.5%.
For us, labor and the environment are the A stories.
But we need your help to keep telling these stories your stories.
One way to do that is to become a WBAI buddy for only $10 a month.
Support WBAI 99.5 to the right of NPR on the dial, and to the left on everything else that matters.
Hey there, friends. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Help us with our recovery. Go to WBAI.org and help us by joining the Buddy System. The more people we have on a recurrent basis giving money to the station, the less we'll have to have fund drives. Help us cut down on those and we'll do what we can for you. WBAI.org, buddy, make a difference.
And this is WBAI in New York, broadcasting at 99.5 megahertz FM. Or as I like to say, WBAI, we are the 99.5. I'm Robert Knight, and please stay tuned for Earthwatch. If you're listening, we're broadcasting at 99.5 megahertz FM and streaming at stream.wbai.org. And tonight on Earthwatch, program dedicated to the issue of the ongoing NSA surveillance and the creation of an invisible state of total information awareness that is not only supported, but has expanded under the operation of President Barack Obama. We'll be looking at his words on that subject, and we'll hear from wiser souls on the issue of privacy, Fourth Amendment protections, constitutionality, etc. So please stay tuned for this edition of Earthwatch on WBAI Pacifica Radio.
The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. The beating sound of the hammer for justice that pounds. When the world stop and listen, when will we all stop and see? He looks upon us with a frown to know that millions of babies still starve. Millions of babies still starve. We can't have the biggest heart if millions of babies still starve. And the innocent ones still die. someone still died. We can't value life too high if the innocent one still died. When will the world stop and listen? When will we all stop and see? When will we find what we've been missing? That the man in the moon must have found, 'cause he looks upon us with a frown. Truth we won't let shine, light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? Light of truth we won't let shine. Long as there's life, there's still a day. Long as there's life, there's still a day. And I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
Greetings and welcome to Earthwatch. Special edition today. In regard to the espionage scandal that continues apace in Washington, Fort Meade, and around the country and around the world, in today's program we'll be hearing from, among others, Barack Obama on his so-called addressing of the issue of NSA surveillance. We'll be hearing from former National Security Agency agent on the real deal in regard to the monitoring of all phone calls, emails, textings, and international and local and other forms of electronic traffic in the United States and around the world. We'll also be hearing some words of historical wisdom about how America is creeping into a state of fascism. And nothing reminds us of that more than the false claims being made by the Obama administration and allied reactionary elements that are opposed to constitutional law, who falsely claim that the accumulation of every phone call, every communication, every email, etc., is somehow related to the war on terror. And even federal studies have indicated that barely 1 to 2% of any prosecutions in regard to so-called terrorism. Terrorism is a very vague conception of law, and we already have existing proscriptions against acts of violence. But in any case, Obama claims that this is about the war on terror and keeping America safe. And the maintenance of the multi-trillion dollar wars that are being waged and that have been escalated by Obama remind me of nothing more than a military and political analyst of the 1940s, 30s and 40s, who said, and here we quote, "Naturally, the common people do not want war. Neither in Russia, nor in England, nor for that matter in Germany. That is understood. But after all, it is the leaders of the country who determine the policy. And it is always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it is a democracy or a fascist dictatorship or a parliament or a communist dictatorship. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them that they are being attacked. And then denounce the peacemakers for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in any country. End quote. And that, not from an American, but from the Nazi leader, Hermann Göring. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight, and you're tuned to WBAI or the stream at WBAI.org or elsewhere throughout the Pacifica network. And we'll kick things off acoustically with some of what Barack Obama had to say about this issue this past Friday.
At the dawn of our republic, a small secret surveillance committee born out of the Sons of Liberty was established in Boston. And the group's members included Paul Revere. At night, they would patrol the streets, reporting back any signs that the British were preparing raids against America's early patriots. Throughout American history, intelligence has helped secure our country and our freedoms. In the Civil War, Union balloons, reconnaissance tracked the size of Confederate armies by counting the number of campfires. In World War II, codebreakers gave us insights into Japanese war plans. And when Patton marched across Europe, intercepted communications helped save the lives of his troops. After the war, the rise of the Iron Curtain and nuclear weapons only increased the need for sustained intelligence gathering. And so, in the early days of the Cold War, President Truman created the National Security Agency, or NSA, to give us insights into the Soviet bloc and provide our leaders with information they needed to confront aggression and avert catastrophe. Throughout this evolution, we benefited from both our Constitution and our traditions of limited government. U.S. intelligence agencies were anchored in a system of checks and balances, with oversight from elected leaders and protections for ordinary citizens. Meanwhile, totalitarian states like East Germany offered a cautionary tale of what could happen when vast, unchecked surveillance from citizens and informers and persecuted people for what they said in privacy of their own homes. In fact, even the United States proved not to be immune to the abuse of surveillance. In the 1960s, the government spied on civil rights leaders and critics of the Vietnam War. And partly in response to these revelations, additional laws were established in the 1970s to ensure that our intelligence capabilities could not be misused against our citizens. In the long twilight struggle against communism, we had been reminded that the very liberties that we sought to preserve could not be sacrificed at the altar of national security. After the fall of the Soviet Union left America without a competing superpower, emerging threats from terrorist groups and proliferation of weapons of mass destruction placed new and in some ways more complicated demands on our intelligence agencies. Globalization and the Internet made these threats more acute, as technology erased borders and empowered individuals to project great violence as well as great good. Moreover, these new threats raised new legal and new policy questions. For while few doubted the legitimacy of spying on hostile states, our framework of laws was not fully adapted to prevent terrorist attacks by individuals acting on their own, or acting in small ideologically driven groups on behalf of a foreign power.
That was not a technical error. I see no reason why your precious time and mine should be wasted with nearly an hour-long speech of third-grade rhetoric that could have been composed in a sixth-grade civics class by the great orator Barack Obama. The bottom line is that he is essentially punting to a committee in order to maintain the status quo, continuing the secrecy of the FISA courts, and saying that basically he is thoroughly disinclined against stopping the violations of the Fourth Amendment by the National Security Agency and affiliated institutions. A clearer perspective of the issue can be had from our friend and frequent guest, David Swanson of warisacrime.org, who says that, and here we quote, President Barack Obama gave a eulogy for the Fourth Amendment on Friday, and not even his fans are proclaiming victory. In this moment, when Obama is actually doing one thing I agree with, that is talking to Iran, more and more people seem to be slowly, agonizingly, slowly, finally, 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 recognizing what a complete huckster he is when it comes to pretty speeches about his crimes. Obama's speech and new so-called policy directive eliminate the Fourth Amendment. Massive bulk collection of everybody's data will continue unconstitutionally, but Obama has expressed a certain vague desire to end it, sort of, except for the parts that are needed, but not to do so right away. The comparisons to the closure of Guantanamo death camps began instantly. Far from halting or apologizing for the abuses of the NSA, Obama defends them as necessitated by the danger of a new 9/11. While drones over Yemen and troops in Afghanistan and so-called special forces in three-quarters of the world are widely understood to endanger us, and while alternatives that upheld the rule of law and made us safer would not require secrecy or human rights violations, Obama wants to continue the counterproductive and immoral militarism while holding off all blowback through the omniscience of Big Brother. End quote. David Swanson. More from him at warisacrime.org. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And up next, a different analysis from a hallowed institution, the American Civil Liberties Union, by way of our dear friend and colleague, the former news editor among the 19 of us who were professional broadcasters removed from the staff of WBAI's lineup, and as who remain as yet uncompensated, Andrea Sears, now with leftvoices.net. And here is Andrea's interlocutory with the American Civil Liberties Union on the issue of Obama, the NSA, and rampant espionage on American citizens and people all over the world.
The long-awaited response to the international furor raised by revelations in NSA documents released by Edward Snowden fell far short of the reforms called for by privacy advocates and the president's own review panel.
The president's speech represents baby steps in what's going to be a very long haul towards a true reform of the NSA.
Brett Max Kaufman is the National Security Fellow in the American Civil Liberties Union's National Security Project.
It's disappointing that he didn't take a more aggressive step today, because that would have really set things in motion. But we do have some really significant legislation that can significantly reform the surveillance apparatus that is being undertaken by the NSA. A lot of this reaction to the speech, I think, shows that the vagueness of it makes it a bit of a Rorschach inkblot, because you have both critics and defenders of the NSA all giving kind of a lukewarm reaction to it. And so I think that just proves that now Congress is going to have to take the lead role in making sure that these reforms are actually enacted.
The president did make some proposals for reform, especially in the collection of telephone metadata. What was your impression of that part of the speech?
I think one of the most important overarching concepts was that the president finally recognized that the data that the government is collecting, especially under the phone records program, under Section 215 of the Patriot Act, contains information that is extremely revealing about sensitive details of Americans' lives. And that's actually quite in contrast to a lot of what the government's been arguing in court and in the court of public opinion about this program. So we welcome that recognition, and President Obama very clearly stated that he understands that it presents a grave threat to both liberty and privacy in this country, and that's very important recognition. At the same time, though, we're pretty disappointed that the president didn't embrace some of the more far-reaching reforms proposed by his own handpicked review group, as well as some congressional legislation that goes much further than the president approached today in his statement. In the last 7 months, we've seen that there are many different programs sweeping up a very large quantity of private information of Americans and others abroad, and it constitutes a very vast spying regime undertaken by the NSA and the American government. And the president's speech does not do very much to get the government out of the business of bulk collection of that kind of information, so that's extremely disappointing.
There was no solid proposal about what he will ultimately do about that program. He's asked Attorney General Holder to come up with some kind of plan within 60 days as to who will hold the information and how it will be accessed. So did he really address the core issue of that vast database, or is it still just a mystery?
I think that's exactly right. He made some changes to how the government can query the data right now, but he did nothing at all to change the fact that the government is holding it onto the data itself and collecting it. Now, he did say that there will be a review until the next time the program comes up for renewal at the end of March, and he's hoping to find an alternative. But for the time being, the government is still in this business, and the president did send some strong signals that he wanted the government to stop collecting this information, but at the same time, he expressed his opinion, which is contrary to a lot of the factual record, that this program is quite important to national security, and it's really anyone's guess as to how this will all shake out in a couple months.
He did issue a presidential directive that says basically that the NSA is not in the business of just randomly collecting and spying on people who are not suspected of being terrorists. But the overall sense that I got was that this was a presidential promise, but not a reaffirmation of Fourth Amendment rights. Are we looking at a shift on a major level of that promise of the right to privacy?
There is some nice language in there recognizing that not just Americans, but all people across the globe should be treated with dignity and respect, and that they have legitimate privacy interests. But again, the details are quite important, and the kind of statements that are in the policy directive do very little to tell us about how in practice a lot of these things will be implemented. And that's been one of the major problems of the government spying regime from the start. Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act is the statute that governs the government's collection of international communications of both Americans and individuals abroad who speak with Americans. And the kind of language that's in the statute leaves a wide array of discretion for individuals in the NSA and the rest of the intelligence community to implement those directives. And while the shift in tone is very welcome, it remains to be seen whether that will carry with it any actual operational changes.
There had been a proposal for an independent advocate to argue sort of the people's case in the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. He's recommending a panel that would be called on in certain cases without specifying how those cases would be determined. Does this answer the concerns about the way that court operates?
Well, I don't think it answers them, but it is a good first step towards restoring some kind of balance and legitimacy to that court. But again, the details will matter a great deal in this. Will it be a panel of experts that gets called on when the judges decide? Will there be some criteria involved in terms of dictating when the privacy advocates will be allowed to participate? What about their role will they be able to make public? These are all very important things that were not answered today. But the general sense seems to be that President Obama does agree with the critics of the FISA court that there needs to be a greater role for someone to contest government assertions, to give information to the court that might not be given by the government, and certainly to test the legal theories that the government is putting forward before a secret court.
The president did not say that he will require court approval for national security letters, which has been another main concern, the overuse of national security letters. This was not number one on the radar at this point because everything's been focused on metadata collection, but seemed to be one area that requires some attention that it didn't get. Why is this remaining in effect the way it is?
It's a great question, and the president's own review group made a very strong recommendation. One of its most important recommendations, actually, was to put these national security letters, which are issued in the tens of thousands a year, behind court orders. And the president didn't even mention those today. So we won't see any court orders in getting in the way of that. It's clear that the president thinks that national security letters are okay. And they are one of the most abusive practices going on in the surveillance and collection of individual Americans' information. So it is extremely disappointing that the president didn't do anything to change that regime today.
Another thing that wasn't addressed in the speech was NSA interception of hardware to install eavesdropping devices or installing backdoors into security software.
That was another thing that was extremely notable, that the president didn't even touch on the issues related to the NSA's efforts with respect to undermining encryption standards and to implanting hardware with spying apparatus. And I think that will be one of the harder slogs, just given the secrecy surrounding those kind of operations. It's not something that necessarily we should expect to see the president speaking about in a speech like this. But in general, the president could have endorsed the concept that the NSA should not be in the business of making us all less secure by undermining the encryption standards that all of us use, not just our enemies. So that was something that was lacking from the speech that many of us expected the president to reassure the country about. And that's, again, quite a disappointing aspect of the speech.
So what is going to be up to Congress and perhaps the courts at this point? I know there's still several outstanding lawsuits going to the Supreme Court very soon. What are we going to see coming up legislatively and judicially on this front?
Well, the Section 215 program is being challenged by the ACLU and by another group in Washington. So those cases are both now before the courts of appeals. But I think you're right that the show really now turns to Congress, because Congress has to act to fill in many of the gaps left by the president to ensure that the government stops collecting information about innocent people, both here and abroad. And legislation like the USA Freedom Act, which is probably the best vehicle out there in Congress that does the most to reform these practices. I mean, whatever you think about the president's proposed reforms, every single one of them could be reversed by a different president or even by President Obama. None of these kinds of things are cemented into law until Congress passes legislation making that so. And so, in particular, legislation is needed to address Section 215. The president spoke about the phone records collection program, but he didn't speak about other kinds of collection under 215, including financial records, internet records, all kinds of records that could be obtained by these bulk collection orders under the government's theory. The president didn't mention those at all, so that's one thing Congress needs to turn to. It also should amend Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act, because the president's proposed tinkering with the proposed purposes and extent of international data collection don't really do anything to upend what is the dragnet surveillance apparatus that is violating constitutional rights and human rights on a global scale. Finally, Congress needs to pass true transparency measures, because Americans and the rest of the world need to know how many of these orders are being used, how many users are being affected, and how much information the government is really collecting from all of us.
Brett Max Kaufman is the National Security Fellow in the ACLU's National Security Project.
And that was Andrea Sears of leftvoices.net. Check her out. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight in New York. The program is heard on many stations of the Pacifica Radio Network. It originates at WBAI and streams at stream.wbai.org. In other response to the Obama essay about surveillance this past Friday, comes from the Establishmentarian Center of the East Coast, the New York Times. And even the Times was disquieted by the lack of substance of Mr. Obama's speech. In an editorial titled, "Mr. Obama's Disappointing Response," the New York Times opines as follows. By the time President Obama gave his news conference on Friday, there was really only one course to take on surveillance policy from an ethical, moral, constitutional, and even political point of view. And that was to embrace the recommendations of his hand-picked panel on government spying, as well as bills pending in Congress, to end the obvious excesses. He could have started by suspending the constitutionally questionable and evidently pointless collection of data on every phone call and email that Americans make. He did not do any of that. Mr. Obama, who 6 months ago said that he thought the data collection struck the right balance between security and civil liberties, said on Friday that the government had not abused its access to private information. He continued to defend the mostly secret internal protocols that the government uses to prevent abuse. He kept returning to the idea that he might be willing to do more, but only to reassure the public, quote, "in light of the disclosures that have taken place," end quote. In other words, he never intended to make the changes that his panel, many lawmakers and others, including this page, have advocated to correct the flaws in the government's surveillance policy had they not been revealed by Edward Snowden's leaks. And that is why any actions that Mr. Obama may announce next month would certainly not be adequate. Congress has to rewrite the relevant passage of the Patriot Act that George W. Bush and then Mr. Obama claimed in secret as the justification for the data vacuuming. Federal lawyers argued their way into a misreading of that passage, which deals with the collection of business records to stop or track down terrorists. But its intent, according to those who wrote the law, was never to allow the National Security Agency to collect and store data on every call and every email, just in case it might be useful. That seems like a clear violation of the Constitution, as well as the spirit of the law. That's the New York Times. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight. And we now present for your consideration a former employee of the National Security Agency and the Signals Intelligence, or SIGINT, Automation Research Center, in the person of Kirk Vibe.
I've had a few moments to think about what I wrote down in terms of what the president said and my reactions to that. So I'm going to say, as a general statement, I'm cautiously optimistic about what I heard from the president. He said more than I honestly expected him to say. He went a bit further in defining some steps that I think are positive, especially about constraining, curtailing the kinds of collection. Having said that, I am now going to focus on what I consider to be the big five minuses and what was not talked about today. First of all, the NSA's existed for about 61 years. It has blatantly violated its charter, the law, for some 41 years of that period of time, and has only been relatively clean for about 20 years of that 61 years. So here we have an agency that is used to cheating. Unfortunately, then, when someone poses fixes that are policy or law, briefings, reports, yearly reviews, all of that to me is fluff. The only way anyone will ever again get the truth about what any NSA is really doing is if a specially trained group of IT people, techies, geeks, hackers, call them what you want. Identify a group that wants to do this, a group that's never been in the intelligence community. Hire them. Give them computers and network access and the clearances to delve into NSA's databases. And I'm talking about all the databases that it uses to do its thing. And verify that data is not being collected that shouldn't be, that data is not being looked at that shouldn't be, that data is not being given to people to whom it should not be given. Until we have that kind of oversight, the cheating that's gone on for 41 years of its existence is going to happen again and again and again. So no verification, as far as I'm concerned, and the president didn't discuss it at all. The word never came up. Remember what Reagan said to Gorbachev? Trust, but verify. Without that last word, we have nothing in the way of progress for privacy. The president said no more spying on foreign leaders. And yet at some point, if you remember, he said we reserve the right to look at all nations' intentions. Now, what's intentions? Does that include foreign leaders? So there's some clarity that has to be sought on that specific issue. I had the same question in my mind. But I do know, technologically speaking, you can successfully process and prosecute bad people in big data without ever disturbing the data of innocent people. There's no balance. And that troubled me too when the president said, well, we have to balance. There is no balance. It's like there's a trade-off. It's totally unnecessary to trade privacy for effectiveness in finding bad people. I'm troubled by something else the president didn't bring up, but that Reuters reported on, that the NSA is giving information, sensitive information, to our law enforcement agencies, the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Agency, and then covering it up. It's not transparent. So that if you have someone accused in a court of law by the United States government, they can't meet their accuser. Their basic rights of justice under the Constitution are de facto not possible. And then they're given orders to cover up the NSA information to make it look like the information came out of a routine FBI or DEA investigation. The president didn't mention any of this. Number three, no one discussed bulk content collection. Now, the government has said we don't do that. That's protected under the Fourth Amendment. You've heard that. You've heard testimony about that. And what did we hear last night? What did The Guardian just report to you? They have a vacuum cleaner for texting. They're sucking up every text message you put out. Texting is content. It involves your phone number as the originator going to someone else or a group of people. You do it all the time. You don't even think about it. And you're a lot younger than I am. You eat that stuff for breakfast. It's hard for me to do. But you do it all the time. And they're sucking it up. That's content, folks. That's not metadata. It was never mentioned. And the White House knew about it. Had to have. The president used the word reasonable suspicion. The words. This is dangerous. For the life of the nation, we have always interpreted the key clause in the Fourth Amendment guaranteeing your rights of privacy to be based on probable cause. Without probable cause, no one has the right to go through your personal effects, papers, things, stuff. They have no right. General Hayden is the first one, the former director of NSA when I was still there, was the first one to redefine the Constitution in front of a reporter. It was on MSNBC. There's a video of it on the web. And Hayden argues with the reporter vehemently that probable cause does not exist in the Fourth Amendment. It's unbelievable to watch for anyone to see. And the president reiterated reasonable suspicion that flies in the face of our national history. We're moving the dot on the Constitution. There's a, you know, if people want to redefine the Constitution describes how to do it. You must call a constitutional convention to get the agreement of the American people. You are in charge. We are in charge. And we need to act like it.
We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights,
that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed.
That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of the evening, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government.
This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we broadcast at 99.5 MHz FM and stream at WBAI.org. And we also remember a time in America when presidents were sometimes called from those of experience and wisdom, more so than empty suits whose reputation is based merely on rhetoric. One such president was Dwight David Eisenhower, who, on the 17th of January 1960, provided us with some words of inescapable wisdom when he spoke about the industrial military complex, telling a nation that, quote, the conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new to the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, and even spiritual, is felt at every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved, and so is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together. Here now, in his own words, President Dwight David Eisenhower.
Rather than mere partisanship, and so have assured that the...
Yeah, here we go.
First, I should like to express my gratitude to the radio and television networks for the opportunities they have given me over the years to bring reports and messages to our nation. My special thanks go to them for the opportunity of addressing you this evening. 3 days from now, after half a century in the service of our country, I shall lay down the responsibilities of office as, in traditional and solemn ceremony, the authority of the presidency is vested in my successor. This evening, I come to you with a message of leave-taking and farewell, and to share a few final thoughts with you, my countrymen. Like every other citizen, I wish the new president and all who will labor with him Godspeed. I pray that the coming years will be blessed with peace and prosperity for all. Our people expect their president and the Congress to find essential agreement on issues of great moment, the wise resolution of which will better shape the future of the nation. My own relations with the Congress, which began on a remote and tenuous basis when long ago a member of the Senate appointed me to West Point, have since ranged to the intimate during the war and immediate post-war period, and finally to the mutually interdependent during these past 8 years. In this final relationship, the Congress and the administration have, on most vital issues, cooperated well. To serve the nation good rather than mere partisanship, and so have assured that the business of the nation should go forward. So my official relationship with the Congress ends in a feeling, on my part, of gratitude that we have been able to do so much together. We now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed 4 major wars among great nations. 3 of these involved our own country. Despite these holocausts, America is today the strongest, the most influential, and most productive nation in the world. Understandably proud of this preeminence, we yet realize that America's leadership and prestige depend not merely upon our unmatched material progress, riches, and military strength, but on how we use our power in the interest of world peace and human betterment. Throughout America's adventure in free government, our basic purposes have been to keep the peace, to foster progress in human achievement, and to enhance liberty, dignity, and integrity among peoples and among nations. To strive for less would be unworthy of a free and religious people. Any failure traceable to arrogance or our lack of comprehension or readiness to sacrifice would inflict upon us grievous hurt, both at home and abroad. Progress toward these noble goals is persistently threatened by the conflict now engulfing the world. It commands our whole attention, absorbs our very beings. We face a hostile ideology, global in scope, atheistic in character, ruthless in purpose, and insidious in method. Unhappily, the danger it poses promises to be of indefinite duration. To meet it successfully, there is call for not so much the emotional and transitory sacrifices of crisis, but rather those which enable us to carry forward steadily, surely, and without complaint, the burdens of a prolonged and complex struggle with liberty, the state. Only thus shall we remain, despite every provocation, on our charted course toward permanent peace and human betterment. Crises there will continue to be. In meeting them, whether foreign or domestic, great or small, there is a recurring temptation to feel that some spectacular and costly action could become the miraculous solution to all current difficulties. A huge increase in newer elements of our defenses, development of unrealistic programs to cure every ill in agriculture, a dramatic expansion in basic and applied research. These and many other possibilities, each possibly promising in itself, may be suggested as the only way to the road we wish to travel. But each proposal must be weighed in the light of a broader consideration, the need to maintain balance in and among national programs. Balance between the private and the public economy. Balance between the cost and hoped for advantages. Balance between the clearly necessary and the comfortably desirable. Balance between our essential requirements as a nation and the duties imposed by the nation upon the individual. Balance between actions of the moment and the national welfare of the future. Good judgment seeks balance in progress. Lack of it he eventually finds imbalance and frustration. The record of many decades stands as proof that our people and their government have, in the main, understood these truths and have responded to them well in the face of threat and stress. But threats, new in kind or degree, constantly arise. Of these, I mention two only. A vital element in keeping the peace is our military establishment. Our arms must be mighty, ready for instant action, so that no potential aggressor may be tempted to risk his own destruction. Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together. Akin to and largely responsible for the sweeping changes in our industrial military posture has been the technological revolution during recent decades. In this revolution, research has become central. It also becomes more formalized, complex, and costly. A steadily increasing share is conducted for, by, or at the direction of the federal government. Today, the solitary inventor, tinkering in his shop, has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research. Partly because of the huge costs involved, a government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded. Yet in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite. It is the task of statesmanship to mold, to balance, and to integrate these and other forces, new and old, within the principles of our democratic system, ever aiming toward the supreme goals of our free society. Another factor in maintaining balance involves the element of time. As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government, must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow. During the long lane of the history yet to be written, America knows that this world of ours, ever growing smaller, must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate, and be instead a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect. Such a confederation must be one of equals. The weakest must come to the conference table with the same confidence as do we, protected as we are by our moral, economic, and military strength.
President Dwight David Eisenhower, in his farewell address, warning the nation about the industrial military, or military industrial if you prefer, complex that was in a transition of becoming dominant, and now we have the military intelligence complex that monitors each and every one of our electronic communications. This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, broadcasting at 99.5, originating at WBAI in New York. I'm Robert Knight, and we reflect on how NSA, FBI, and government espionage affects not only ourselves, but those who we truly and deeply love. Throughout the history of the social change that was simultaneous with the times in which President Eisenhower headed the executive branch, and succeeding administrations in which opponents of progress and supporters of military operations tried to make a living hell out of the life of people seeking righteous change, including the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who was hounded and harassed and had offices and facilities broken into by the FBI in an attempt to break his spirit. But they didn't, and we have more during this week of celebrating his life and birthday about the work of Martin Luther King from various speakers, including Ossie Davis. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight.
A time comes when silence is betrayal. I come to this platform tonight to make a passionate plea to my beloved nation.
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is the most celebrated leader of black struggle in America.
King is memorialized as this person who is all about peace and let's hold hands and get together. But
we've eliminated the more radical aspects of Martin Luther King Jr.'s critique.
The creation of an image into a version of heroism that is acceptable to the state, to the power source.
And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
April 4th, 1967. Speech at Riverside Church.
In that last year of his life, King argued that the victories of the late 50s and the early 60s were cheap.
He had gone through changing legislation, and that was why he got the Voting Rights Act of 65. They achieved their initial goal.
But even Dr. King said that, you know, it goes beyond the Voting Rights Act.
So the question for King was, what's next for him in this popular movement that he was leading?
Phase one was the struggle against segregation, against Jim Crow.
He started to trend away from just racial segregation and more towards their economic power structures.
True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring.
And so the Poor People's Campaign was to be phase two of this struggle to create a better America.
We have that King dismissed and erased.
But King is a figure whose real ideas and real legacy have been, to borrow a phrase, buried under a mountain of praise.
Given to us in a version who talked sort of emptily, vapidly about a dream.
So the challenge for us is to excavate, if you will, those real ideas and that real legacy.
That no one who has any concern for the integrity and life of America today can ignore the present war. They must see Americans as strange liberators. So far we may have killed a million of them. I cannot be silent.
I think the most important fact of Dr. King's journey was his split with Lyndon Johnson over the war.
Johnson, at the time, flipped out in the Oval Office screaming, "What is that goddamn nigger preacher doing to me?"
He was reviled and despised by white America, followed by the FBI, labeled a communist and anti-American.
Time magazine called King, quote, "a drawling bumpkin, so ignorant that he had not read a newspaper in years."
Dr. King broke with the most powerful man in the world. That split really described not just Dr. King's politics, but his courage and his character.
These are the times for real choices and not false ones. I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values.
It's really interesting to me how timeless King is. Timeless. What he was preaching back then is so very relevant today.
We don't get the kind of support that we deserve here while money is being spent, as we see now, the billions of dollars a day to oppress somebody overseas.
And it also tells us just how far we have not come.
So, you know, every Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, we want to honor the real King.
The real King.
Though the civil rights leaders, for various reasons, refuse or can't take a stand or have to go along with the administration, that's their business. But I must say tonight that I know that justice is indivisible. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
It is estimated that some 1 million Vietnamese children have been casualties of this brutal war. A war in which children are incinerated by napalm, in which American soldiers die in mounting numbers, while other American soldiers, according to press accounts, in unrestrained hatred shoot the wounded enemy as they lie on the ground. It is a war that mutilates the conscience. These casualties are enough to cause all men to rise up with righteous indignation and oppose the very nature of this evil war. But the physical casualties of the war in Vietnam are not alone the catastrophes. The casualties of principles and values are equally disastrous and injurious. If the casualties of principle are not healed, the physical casualties will continue to mount. One of the first casualties of the war in Vietnam was the Charter of the United Nations. In taking armed action against the Viet Cong and North Vietnam, the United States clearly violated the UN Charter, which provides in Chapter 1, Article 2, that all members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations. And in Chapter 7, it states that the Security Council shall determine the existence of any threat to peace, breach of the peace, or act of aggression, and shall make recommendations or shall decide what measures shall be taken to maintain or restore international peace and security. It is very obvious that our government blatantly violated its obligation under the Charter of the UN to submit to the Security Council its charge of aggression against North Vietnam. Instead, we unilaterally launched an all-out war on Asian soil. In the process, we have undermined the purpose of the UN and caused its effectiveness at many points to atrophy. We have also placed our nation in the position of being morally and politically isolated. Even the long-standing allies of America have adamantly refused to join our government in this ugly war. As Americans and lovers of democracy, we should carefully ponder the consequence of our nation's declining moral status in the world. The second casualty of the war in Vietnam is the principle of self-determination. By entering a war that is little more than a domestic civil war, America has ended up supporting a new form of colonialism covered up by certain niceties of complexity. Whether we realize it or not, our participation in the war in Vietnam is an ominous expression of our lack of sympathy for the oppressed, our paranoid anti-communism, our failure to feel the ache and anguish of the have-nots. It reveals our willingness to continue participation in neo-colonialist adventures. A brief look at the background and history of this war reveals with brutal clarity the ugliness of our policy. The Vietnamese people proclaimed their own independence in 1945. After the combined French and Japanese occupation, and before the Communist Revolution in China, they were led by the now well-known Ho Chi Minh. Even though they quoted the American Declaration of Independence in their own document of freedom, we refused to recognize them. Instead, we decided to support France in its reconquest of her former colony. President Truman felt then that the Vietnamese people were not ready for independence. And we again fell victim to the deadly Western arrogance that has poisoned the international atmosphere for so long.
Brothers and sisters, we gather at this spot in Central Park to make a statement of expression of how we feel about the world as it stands before us. A great man has fallen, and the world waits for our response. The fact that he was an apostle of love and nonviolence might have led many in the world to mistake his personal courage as a man. But nobody who listened to the last words he said on the night before he was slain can doubt that Martin Luther King was one of the bravest black men we have lost in the struggle. Martin King left us not only the example of his life and of his thoughts and his philosophies and his teachings. But this is more important to the young people in our country, to the black people in our country. He left us the example of his death. He knew it was coming. And he didn't run. He didn't change. He didn't back down. He went forward and he met it like a black man always meets it. Now, why was Martin Luther King in Memphis? Was he there just preaching sermons? No. Was he there holding a seminar on nonviolence? No. He was not there delivering a lecture or receiving a Nobel Prize from the high powers of the world. He went to Memphis to help his black deprived brothers win their bargaining rights from the city of Memphis. And we have got to go and see that they give it to them. They talk to us. They talk to us about what kind of people we are. They laugh at us because we have to feed our families from what we can get on welfare. They say to us, why do you ask the government to do so much for you and the government hasn't done anything for anybody else? They say that we love welfare, that we are not men, that we don't care for our wives and our children, that we don't want to work. And Memphis men are trying to work, trying to earn enough to send their kids to schools, to put breads on their tables, and you kill the man! How much America do you expect us to bear? There is no time left. When we had another brother who stood up for his people, he was gunned down in February of 1965, Malcolm X.
Yes!
Just before Malcolm died, he went down to Selma, where Martin Luther King was having some trouble, and Malcolm went to offer him his hand in friendship. And Malcolm said, we may differ, Martin King, on tactics, we may differ on philosophy, we may differ on many things, but you are black and I am black, and let's not forget that, and let's stand together on that basis. And isn't it prophetic? Isn't it prophetic that just a few weeks ago, Martin Luther King, Nobel Prize winner, big man in the world, popular with black folks, popular with white folks, Martin Luther King went to Newark and visited Leroy Jones and said the same brotherhood statement that Malcolm had made to him. The fact that we are black is enough to establish our unity and the basis of our fight in this country. My wife and I are looking forward to being in Memphis on Monday to carry forward the march that Dr. King was going to. I don't know. The Southern, Dr. King's body is back in Atlanta. The leaders are having a meeting deciding what is to be done. So I don't know what the circumstances are. I do know there will be a march. And I do know that I want to be in that number. And I would like to feel that those of you who stand here, black and white, shamed, insulted, spat in the face of your manhood and your dignity and your belief in democracy by that stupid fool and his bullet in Memphis, that you will be there too. On to Memphis! Those brothers, those black brothers in Memphis who sent for Martin King, they still need our help. They put up a brave fight, and they lost one of us. But for every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey, 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 hey. And as I stand before you, as I stand before you, I don't ask whether you are a white Martin or whether you are a black Martin. I ask first if you are a man, and second, if you believe that men should stand or fall for freedom, and third, if you believe that the time for that freedom is now, that you will take those steps now. Now! Now! Thank you. Thank you very much.
Right about now, we would like to introduce a man who is supposed to run with Dr. Martin Luther King as vice president on the freedom ticket in California. He is the foremost authority on helping people evade the draft. He has been arrested many times for helping us, the brothers and sisters. I want to give to you now none other than Dr. Spock.
What I want to say now is particularly to the white people in the audience here. The President's Commission on Civil Disorders came in with a pretty good report, much more honest than most reports of its kind. What has been the effect? Generally speaking, it has been greeted with a significant silence. The President hasn't even had the courage to say that he supported it. He only said that he recommended that people read it and study it. Richard Nixon characteristically came out more flat-footedly. He said that it didn't put enough emphasis on oppression in the streets, and we know where he stands. There is an enormous job to be done to get racial justice in the United States. Even if all of us start with all the enthusiasm and strength that we have, it still is going to take one decade, two decades, three decades to really get justice in this country. But it's time for us to start. Dr. King stood not just for nonviolence. Dr. King stood for militancy. And there is, the white people will do no honor to Dr. King if they just say, too bad, he was a wonderful man. The only meaning that we can take from his death is to rededicate ourselves to become militant in trying to get racial justice in this country.
Richie Havens is here. I'm going to quote him.
There must be some way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There's so much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine, proud men dig my earth. None of them along the line know what any of it is worth. No, no. No need to get excited.
finally spoke. There's too many among us that think that life is but a joke. You and I, we've been through that. This is not our fate. Let us not speak falsely now. The hour is getting late, 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 late. All along the watchtower, the princess kept the view. The women came and went, barefoot servants too. Hey, outside in the distance, a wildcat did growl. Two riders came approaching, the wind began to howl. Yeah, yeah. But remember, it's all along the watchtower, all along the watchtower, all along the watchtower, all along the watchtower.
Hey, let me give you Pete Seeger.
Be dedicated like this man till racism no longer rules this land.
Thank you for listening to Earthwatch tonight here on BAI. Please send an email to your host, Robert Knight. That's RKNIGHT at WBAI.org.
And were you there when they laid his precious body in the tomb? Oh, sometimes it causes me to tremble. I tremble.
Were you there when they laid him in the tomb?
I and I are Rastafari.
Due to popular demand, we, the award-winning Midnight Ravers, will continue our exploration of Rastafarianism. So please join us on Friday, January 24th, 2014, from 12 midnight to 2 a.m., as we proudly present Blacker Black, Nyabingi Voice of the Lion, Part 2, only on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. Miss it and hate yourself.
The Midnight Ravers, where every show is a special.
From the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, I'm Deborah James with Healthcare 411, information for better health. One out of 110 children in the U.S. has an autism spectrum disorder, which includes autism, Asperger syndrome, and pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified. Common to these disorders are repetitive behaviors, trouble communicating, and difficulty with social interactions. Some children may also have impaired cognitive skills and sensory perception. A new free guide from ARC gives parents further insight into these conditions and the various treatment options available. ARC's Dr. Stephanie Chang explains.
This free guide is titled Therapies for Children with Autism Spectrum Disorders. It offers descriptions of various treatments and an explanation of benefits and harms. This way, parents can be better informed to discuss the possible treatment options with their child's pediatrician.
For the free guide, visit effectivehealthcare.ahrq.gov. Healthcare 411 is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Hi, this is Jerry Stiller. You are listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Where are my keys? Anybody see my keys? Who took my keys?
The hour of the wolf is the hour between night and dawn. It is the hour when most people die, when sleep is deepest, when nightmares are most real. It is the hour when the sleepless are haunted by their deepest fear, when ghosts and demons are most powerful. The hour of the wolf is also the hour when most children are born. Ingmar Bergman's Hour of the Wolf. The hour in which reality becomes a mockery of madness and masks hide behind faces. The hour of all final moments. Liv Ullmann in Ingmar Bergman's Hour of the Wolf, a diary of truths and lies like truths.
Thank you.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, imagination, and enchantment. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, a recorded edition and a semi-repeat, we'll be listening to an interview conducted with Ken Liu last March. This is a fascinating one. Stay tuned.